Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode of See Here is dedicated to the loving memory of Mr. Lou Ottens.
Welcome to episode 114 of the See Here podcast. We took a month off because why not? But here we are back in full force. I want to welcome my usual collaborators, my friends on this show, out in Brantford, Mr. Tim Merrill.
Hello.
In Cape Cod, Ms. Kerry Fristo.
Hello.
And welcoming back to See Here for the first time since episode 100, which seems like 5 years ago, but it was only maybe a year and a half. The head honcho at the projection booth and at Weirding Way Media, Mr. Mike White.
Oh boy, I'm no head honcho, but thank you for the very kind words. It's great to be here.
Lovely to have you back. This is the second time I've spoken with you on a podcast in the last couple of weeks because we're doing this as a bit of a swap-a-rooney sort of thing. A couple of weeks ago, I was guest on the projection booth to talk about a lovely little documentary about American college radio called 35,000 Watts. You want to give a little bit of a description for those who haven't seen the film, what 35,000 Watts was about, Mike?
35,000 Watts was a story of college radio and its influence on music and music's influence on it. They really concentrated on the 90s, which was great for me because that's when I was a DJ, our local college radio station. So that was very nice. And I actually trimmed out the discussion of mixtapes because by the time I got to the editing part of that, you had invited me to be on this. So saving all the good stuff for this episode.
The film that we're going to be talking about this time is one that Tim has picked, a documentary that you can search at on YouTube or on Tubi. It's there. The film is called Cassette, a documentary mixtape. So we'll play you the trailer and then come back in a moment to talk about this 2016 documentary. You're listening to See Here.
Using a tape recorder can be a big bother. That was before we reinvented tape recording. This is the compact cassette.
Here is a photo of an enormous cassette I made in pieces and threw away.
This is my first ever cassette.
The cassette could do your own dealio.
Cassette, like, was your gateway into creativity.
Cassettes didn't play a role in hip-hop in the early days. Cassettes were hip-hop.
There was no rap radio. There was no video. There was nothing.
And there's something about that electric sound that is amazing. For me, it was as good as it gets.
The craziest thing, it's not yet over. I realize that there are numbers of people who are still using it.
Every artifact might die with whatever is digital.
If you still have any tape, it's because you care about it. You choose to keep it alive.
If you threw away all your old music cassettes, you might be kicking yourself now. Tapes are making a comeback.
We are making more audio cassettes now than we have ever made before.
We expected it would be a success, but not a revolution.
Hello.
Tim, Kerry, Mike, and myself, we're here to talk with you about Cassette, a documentary mixtape. I kept sort of writing notes thinking a mixtape documentary, to switch those two words around. The film came out in 2016, directed by Zach Taylor, and it features a fellow called Lou Ottens, who will be having a lot to talk about, I'm sure, credited with the invention of the cassette tape, although he's quite happy to share that credit with three other very interesting gentlemen. We'll be talking about them. Henry Rollins, who seems to be, I think he's quite ubiquitous in music documentaries. He has a lot to say. And a man who I know that you're a huge fan of, Tim, Mike Watt from the Minutemen, and a lot of other people who I didn't know, but I think that's possibly the point. So the IMDb description is: cassette inventor Lou Ottens digs through his past to figure out why the audio tape won't die. Rock veterans like Henry Rollins, Thurston Moore, and Ian MacKaye join a legion of young bands releasing music on tape to push Lou along on his journey to remember. So we've previously featured episodes on this show devoted to films about the medium of which music is presented rather than the music itself. And they've usually been dedicated to records or vinyls, as the kids like to call them nowadays. This is the first time we're talking about cassettes as a medium. I'm looking forward to someone making a documentary about compact discs. But I want to go around the table and ask each one of you, we'll start off with you, Mike, as our guest, how much of your music listening life has been dedicated either in the past or current day to cassettes?
There was a period of my life where it was just all cassettes. We had a record player at home. I did buy some records when I was younger, and I kept buying records all the way up until 1994, and probably still buy a few every now and then, especially when it comes to like rare soundtracks or just like weird albums that I want to pick up. But yeah, for the most part, when I was in high school and in early college, it was all cassettes all the time, especially making a lot of mixtapes for myself and for other folks. And then, yeah, I would say I've had to rebuy pretty much everything on CD over the years, or now MP3. But yeah, cassettes were huge for me. And it was just the way that I got introduced to so many bands, and the way that I shared music, and driving around in my car with a whole case of cassettes. That was my life for a long time. So I would say at least 8 years, if not more, just fully dedicated to cassettes.
So how much of your cassette listening was due to tapes that you'd made, either recording off other people's records, or people had made mixtapes for you, or pre-recorded cassettes that you'd get from the record store?
I would say it's probably 60-40 as far as music that I bought versus music that I created or put together on mixtapes. And I would have one mixtape going at a time at least, and just kept adding to it. I would hear somebody play a song, I would ask them to borrow the cassette, put that on there, or we would go to the mall and buy a single and use the single and put that on there. You know, also recording, not necessarily off the radio, but definitely off of album, just taking those select tracks that you wanted off of that and putting it on there. I'm still sitting next to a record player, a tape player, and then I've got the CD player over here. So I still have all this stuff just in case I need to transfer something over. But yeah, that was my thing. I loved making mixtapes. I had friends that made incredible mixtapes, and there's some that I still listen to today.
Harry, how about you?
My first music experience was always with albums, with LPs. And then I would buy 45 sometimes if it was a hit song that I really wanted to have. I think the first one I ever bought was Crocodile Rock.
Oh, wow.
But I bought for Duke, the Stevie Wonder. Yeah.
You still have that in your collection, should I ask?
No, I don't. I don't want to talk about my collection.
Okay.
It's a sad, sad story. But I actually, the first mixtapes that I had were 8-track. Because I'm older than you. So my dad had an 8-track player in his car. We had a really nice stereo. We had 4 LPs, and you could play singles. You know, you could play 45s on it, but you could also play 8-tracks. And so we would make mixtapes with 8-tracks. I remember the big thing was the math. So you were like trying to get it to be on the same side, because 8-track, it would do that chunk chunk and change to the next track. So there were songs that I knew forever, you know, and in the middle there would be a chunk, you know, I'm waiting for that chunk sound when I hear it now even. But he used to make mixtapes when we would go skiing up north. And like, there's a Chicago tune called, I think it's just called Snow. And it's like, snow, 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 snow. And for some reason, so there was a whole snow themed one. There were all these themes. My dad was really into that. My dad was a DJ too. And then when we got cassettes, we, you know, made those too. But I remember not just recording within a system, but also literally holding it up to the radio. Just like what, how Henry Rollins says in the movie, when you have a band, and I was in bands all through that time too, when I was in junior high school, we would have the little tiny one that looked like this tiny little one that like you'd see in school, and hit the two buttons and point it at the band and we would play. And so that was the time you could record your band that way. Yeah. I recorded myself singing that way, but I recorded stuff like just holding it next to the radio too. But we had tons of mixtapes. My dad used to send them to me because for years I lived away from home, and he would send me these themed mixtapes. And what he did was he did mystery theme. So I'd had to guess what the theme was, and he would pick these esoteric songs to put together and say, okay, what do you think the theme was? And stuff like that. It was really fun. So I didn't buy a ton of cassettes. I bought some. Most of the cassettes that I had were mixtapes that either I made or my dad made, or stuff that like somebody had a record and I didn't have the record. And so they would record it for me and give, and you know, hey, you know, I'll give you a tape. If you could record that new record off me, that way I don't have to buy the record and pay the whole $6 for an album.
Those are the days.
I know. Yeah, that's what I remember about him. But I do remember mixtapes, and I do remember all the stuff about like, because my dad's was an artist. So he would draw all over them and have these really interesting things and write my name in this weird script and things like that. And so that's what I remember. It's mostly between my dad and I, not friends as much, but some.
I'm going to say something right now that's pretty profound. Shock and surprise, right? I want to say that the cassette tape, to me, had more of an effect on me than any other format, including vinyl. I was able to define friendships through the cassette tape that still exists to this day. I was able to get laid through the cassette tape. The cassette tape was the internet before the internet. When you and I were together, Morris, in Melbourne, when I visited you and I found a copy of an old fanzine, Maximum Rock and Roll, that still existed. And Maximum Rock and Roll for the punks was really an important zine in the fact that in the back of Maximum Rock and Roll, they had their classifieds where people would list all their tape trading, the bootlegs of the shows, or bands would have their demos. And it was basically a Sears catalog of cassettes. And this is long before the internet. So, I mean, the cassette tape, to me, was the most organic, most authentic, because of the mixtape. You couldn't do mix vinyl. And, Carrie, you're right, there was the mix 8-track. But there was something about the cassette tape that was so heartfelt. It could be almost like poetry, where people today, and I'm not trying to be the old man on the porch with the young kids and their TikToks and their, you know, all of this. But some people have tried to say to me that a playlist today on YouTube or Spotify can be just as equal on the same level as a mixtape. And all I have to say to that is smoke another one, Cheech. I'm sorry, but it's just not happening. I mean, there was something about the mixtape, and even not even the mixtape, but just there's a line in a John Prine song, Souvenirs, Graveyards and Old Pawn Shops, because they always bring me tears. All the memories that they robbed me of my childhood souvenirs. I've got cassette tapes. Actually, I have one specific cassette tape. My father's brother, my Uncle Mike, he died when he was 40 in a traffic accident. But I've got a cassette tape of him playing guitar with my little cousin Melanie singing. She's got to be about 3 or 4 years old. And she didn't even know I had it. And he had given it to my dad to put away. And now Melanie is a grown adult, and I've still yet to spring it on her because she doesn't even know. And that's something that's eternal. The cassette tape, to me, I can't even put it into words. And you know how I like to yak, but I just can't even put it into words how important the cassette tape is. And it's something that can be shared by younger generations. And I do admire these people. And it's not like kids saying, well, my current generation is shit, so I'm being nostalgic, I want to glom onto yours. You're welcome to it. I think the cassette can live. That's how the cassette was so viral, too, when you really think about like hip-hop and rap and all of it. I mean, NWA, all of that. Before YouTube, before viral was even viral. And there was times when you could make that mixtape where you could have Slayer with NWA, with the Circle Jerks, and then have Nina Hagen and whatever. And you could put anything you wanted on it. And it just flowed. And nobody ever said, well, that doesn't go with that. Everyone just kind of listened and went, wow, I never thought that would flow, but it did. Like, it's just, there was just something about the cassette tape that, like I say, that it's still to this day, Lou Ods scratches his head as much as he went next, you know, as you watch the documentary and he's looking at the next format, he still thought, there's still something about this that I'll never figure out. And it's like the cave, like original cave paintings, like in France on the walls. As much as we can say, yeah, you know, like this is pretty primitive and it's a cave painting, there's still something that we'll never, ever understand about how profound it is.
I'm probably going to be the contrarian here. I mean, look, like all of you, I had a history with cassette tapes and I used them as much as anyone did for recording albums that we used to get told that you shouldn't be recording albums because that's an infringement of copyright, but we all recorded stuff.
Taping is killing the music industry.
Where I assure you, this is going to be a point of discussion later on in the episode. But yeah, I was recording stuff. I was also recording things off the radio. I remember my friend Michael and I would be putting tapes together, like he'd have the tape or I'd have the tape. We'd be frustrated thinking, damn it, I don't seem to be listening to the radio when Bohemian Rhapsody is playing. Maybe you'll have some luck. Can you get that on the tape for me? As kids, you can't afford to be buying records or can't afford to be buying every single that you want. But there was, I remember, you know, sitting in front of the radio trying to get Bohemian Rhapsody or Dylan's Hurricane, which they'd play the full 8 minutes of, the big single in 1975 or 76. And that was something that I really adored doing. But as I know that we've also discussed in the past, Tim, the pencil loomed large in our...
And tape, over tape and over the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I found that I had this love-hate relationship with tapes because I'd fall in love with the music on a tape. And then after so many plays, it'd start to sound muffled or would get caught up in the tape player. Whilst I have a level of nostalgia for the tape, I'm under no illusions. So at least not in my head. That's not to short sell your experience, but I don't really miss it as a medium.
What's funny is what you were talking about getting caught up in the tape player and all of that. One of the funnier things I found was that, do you remember when your battery started to go in your Walkman or something and it started to, and all of a sudden it would start to slow down. And a lot of times what I heard, I loved. When it was like suddenly, it's almost like the Butthole Surfers or something, you know, where you would just get this slower version of like Black Sabbath or something. And you just go, this is great. Man, like, I wish I could record this, like the meltdown, because this is good.
I had my tape player in my car where I listened to most everything that I ever listened to. It was slightly faster than any other player around my home, anybody else's. So people would get into my car and they'd just be like, I've never heard this version before. And I never, it didn't really like catch on for me. And I'd be like, oh, this is, what are you guys talking about? And then finally I was like, oh yeah, it's a little bit faster. So I know exactly what you're talking about, Tim, but on the other angle of it, yes.
I have a story that Joe reminded me of maybe just a few days ago. I said, will you record this for the show? She said, no, I don't do that, but I'll tell you the story. You can repeat it. And it was a big deal at the time. Maybe the way how I'm going to describe it doesn't sound so much, but years ago, we went on a camping hiking trip with a bunch of friends. I think my friend Julian was driving in his little Datsun 120Y or whatever it was. And he had a tape player in the car, which he had a tape of the band Not Drowning Waving. I think it was their album Claim, which made me fall in love with that band, that drive up. But the problem was that even though the tape would play, he couldn't get it out of the cassette player. Because the tape was in the player, he couldn't get the radio on. So if he was in the car, the only sound he could get was Not Drowning Waving's Claim album. And it got him frustrated. So Joanne, who seemed to have a good knack with a coat hanger, I know that she'd opened up a number of car doors with a coat hanger, and no, that was not her profession. She was not a professional thief or anything like that. But she said, let me see what I can do. And I'm whispering in her ear, so don't fuck up Julian's tape player. She said, what have I got to lose? And she got the coat hanger and got the tape out, and it was curved. It was, for some reason, it was still playing, but it was curved.
Wow.
Got it out. So I said to her, you know, you ought to sort of go and find yourself a career as a car tape fixer or something.
It's a very niche kind of position. Oh, yeah. But yeah, you know.
One of the first times I ever visited Skiz down in Baltimore, he had, I think it was Frank's Wild Years was stuck in his tape player. And so we listened to that all weekend.
Wow.
I became a Tom Waits fan after that. But then we started to sing other people's songs in the style of Tom Waits. And I think if Tom Waits ever did a cover of Smith's songs, I think that would be pretty rad, because that's what we kept doing.
As far as like cassettes coming back, a lot of people don't understand it. I usually just tell them, hey, we've sold 100,000 cassettes in the last 5 years. And they're like, really? And I say, yeah.
But who's counting?
I have a lot of CDs. I'm a physical media person. I don't have any music on Spotify. I don't have Apple Music. I don't have any of that. I have CDs now. I had a record collection. I don't want to talk about it, but it was basically stolen. So that's kind of a drag. But I have CDs. And what I miss is when I was a kid, because I always sang. When I was a kid, listening to vinyl, I got very good at being able to pinpoint down to the place in the song that I wanted to hear again without hurting the album. You know, got to be pretty skilled at that. And the same thing with the cassette player, because you could rewind it to the place that you wanted to start again. And it's like, okay, I need to practice that verse again. Okay, I can go back. Well, that's the thing that I miss about both vinyl and cassette, is that with CDs, you could play the song or you cannot play the song, but you can't back it up to the middle, and or I can't anyway. Maybe someone has that technology, but I don't have it in any of my players. You can't do that anymore. And that's really a drag, because there are parts that I would listen to just to get it, because you wanted to hear it, you wanted to get it. And I would listen to it over and over again. And you're talking about like wearing out the tape, and at many plays, all of a sudden at one point it goes all wonky on you. And one of the reasons is because I would play the same part 500 times before I got that part. So I must say, I do really miss that part of the cassette and the vinyl LP experience, you know.
Here's the thing that's really interesting. There's a segment of the film where somebody actually says that the cassette tape and the cassette player was a canvas, and that it was a way to create. And what's really interesting is, I mean, like I was talking earlier about NWA and like with samples for hip hop, and not just samples for hip hop, but it's like one of my favorite bands of all time is a band, Steel Pole Bathtub, that came out of San Francisco and Montana. Well, anyway, they would actually, long before, like, I mean, today with EDM, you can walk on stage with a MacBook with a million samples. But these guys actually were all gear nerds and figured out a way to go to the local radio shack and set up pedal triggers with cassette players. So they'd have like four or five cassette players on stage, and they'd have their samples, and they'd just kick a pedal and just would play the sample right off a tape and just go right into their song. And they'd have four or five different samples in every song. So they just have, you know, whereas, you know, a lot of bands would have different effects for their guitars, these guys would have different triggers for different cassette players. And it's incredible how they saved all those cassettes, and they broke up and then they got back together, and they're playing now, and they're having to actually archive all the samples from the old cassettes that they had. And they're trying, it's almost like, you know, like digging through an older century, you know, like saying the Terracotta Warriors, and trying to find those old samples on the cassettes and trying to basically get them into players again and do it the same way. They're not feeding them in the MacBooks. They're putting them into players on stage. Even not even that, but they're actually trying to sample, like trying to put them into a sampler off the tape too as well. So, I mean, cassettes became almost like with William Burroughs, when he talked about his cut-ups, where he could take two separate things and take a page off of one book, split it down the middle, take another book and put them together, and you'd have something entirely new that was cryptic, but still amazing. That's what you could do with cassettes. And I think that's what they're talking about in the film, as well as the cassettes being a canvas. And what Carrie was saying about rewinding it to that point of getting it. I mean, everybody had that, you know, like we've all said, we've got our favorite parts of songs, whether it be a riff or a sing or an element of singing or the chorus or whatever. And you could tell almost like the early days of VHS when there was those kind of dodgy aspects of, like, for example, I'm just bringing up Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It was always the Phoebe Cates.
I knew you were going to say that.
The Phoebe Cates part that, you know, like when you rented it, that was the part that was always worn out because that was the part that everybody was always rewinding, right? So, I mean, that's what cassettes were like too, because you had your favorite songs on mixtapes and that's where it usually broke. That's where the tape usually just was like, okay, we've had it. Play it too many times. You're done. You're out.
Yeah, I don't know how entirely successful the documentary is. Like, there's a lot of parts I like, but it feels like he's playing, he being Zach, the director, and I know it's a three-director thing, but I think he has the credit on there. It's like he's playing with certain things like answering machines or language learning tapes or just like all of these different modes where cassettes came into play. I was surprised he didn't talk about how cassettes could actually be used for recording data. Like, I had a friend who had an Atari computer and he had a tape player rather than a disk drive. Even when it came, there was a shot of an old lady in the movie and I was like, well, was this recorded on like a Pixel cam? Because those actually used tapes as their medium as well. You could record video onto an audio medium, which was kind of bizarre. So he's kind of playing with that stuff, doing things like the whole thing, like Carrie talking about, like, oh, she would get messages from her dad, or like, you know, like mixtapes from her dad, or like that whole thing of like recording with your family. I have so many recordings of my grandmother or me when I was a kid, or when you would send tapes to other people and record yourself on there. It's like there's a lot of, you know, I mean, it's a huge medium, and he does a great job of using kind of pre-made things, using samples of like, oh, here's this new medium. This is fantastic. But it feels like it doesn't go far enough. This documentary just feels a little split up between what is the medium. Here's the very reluctant, I guess, like curmudgeonly inventor of the medium who, yeah, he's just kind of done with it before the documentary even starts. And then all the talking head interviews. And I usually don't like talking head interviews, but I have to say, like, yeah, you mentioned like Henry Rollins is in every freaking, you know, music documentary, him, Ian MacKay. I was very glad to see Mike Watt because I don't tend to see him too often. I was just surprised they didn't get, well, I mean, they had Thurston Moore. He's another one who's in everything. I'm just surprised they didn't get Jon Waters for no reason whatsoever, because he shows up in anybody's documentary too. Right. And then the guy from the Circle Jerks, Keith Morris.
Yep.
Yes, he shows up in every music documentary as well. I was kind of grateful that he wasn't in this one.
There's a lot of people that would show up to the opening of an envelope.
I used to think Elvis Costello was that guy, but I think he's been a bit quiet in recent years.
Right.
But to your point, Mike, I'm in two minds as to how successful the film was. But one thing that it seemed to me, how the film presented itself was given away in the title, you know, cassette, a documentary mixtape. Yeah. And by going between all these different people, seemingly unrelated, it was like that mixtape. You know, you could have your tape that you'd gone and put yourself together with whoever. You'd have an ABBA song and you'd have a Queen song and you'd have a, you know, this song and that song, and seemingly unrelated. And then you'd come back, I feel like doing another Queen song, or I feel like throwing in Anarchy in the UK or whatever. But so you'd come back to these people, and it seemed like it was a very deliberate thing to have this done as a mixtape. So thinking, well, why are we going from a couple of guys who are running some niche record store in Los Angeles to Lou Ottens and his friends, and to the one factory left, where was it? Somewhere in the South, I think.
Missouri.
Midwest. Right. So I think I liked that as an experiment. I will come up later with at least one thing that I think there was a glaring omission from the film. But overall, certainly having Lou Ottens and his other, I've written down the name, so let's give him credit. Lucien de Vaugelaire, Willie Leenders, and Hugo Vanen de Roy. I've gone and destroyed their names, I'm sure, as well as Lou Ottens.
Right. But
they were all involved in the planning, the design, and the development of the cassette and the environment that they would be manufactured in. So all very important people. And we'll have some other stuff to say about them, I'm sure. But I think one thing that was in common with them and the films that we just recently discussed, The Immediate Family and The Wrecking Crew, crew was I got the same feeling watching them talk around the table as the musicians in those films did, talking about their past. But instead of a bunch of musicians who were talking about their groundbreaking music that changed everything, these fellows are talking about their groundbreaking invention that affected the way we were able to listen to and consume music.
The problem begins at the moment that we introduced the cassette. A year after our introduction, there came a lot of imitations in Japan. And then we said, well, gentlemen, if you want to imitate our cassette, you better make a standard, because without a standard, it gets a mess over in the whole world. And that worked. That's the reason that it didn't become obsolete too early. But it's taken 50 years to die.
There's three distinct perspectives to me, is that Lou Auden's, like, when he's talking, you have to remember, like, there's a lot of times when we kind of romanticize when people create things, you know, that artists create things or inventors, that we think this is how they would see it, and it's not how they see it at all. And I think Lou Auden's, you have to remember, first and foremost, he was an engineer, and engineers are always chasing shadows. They're always just like next, 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 next. And he wasn't trying to hold this up and say, this is the definitive format, this is it forever and ever and ever until infinity. No. And then you've got Ian MacKay, who is like, you know, he's not looking at it from a commercial aspect, because he's one of the least commercial guys with Fugazi. I mean, shit, I remember seeing Fugazi where they would refuse to charge any more than $10 to get in the door any time in their whole history. But he does make the point where he says, look, we just came up with an album, Red Medicine. And then he says, you know, a couple of days later, he says, I've got a warehouse full of these cassette tapes because CDs just took over. What am I going to do with these things? So there's that. And then you've got Rollins, who wants to be the archivist, who's just kind of like, this is going to be like the Smithsonian. We've got to have this all. He's like the OCD guy, where he's just, you know, got to have it all filed away and ferreted away. And 100 years later, when everybody figures out, well, what were we all about? It's all there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, like you're saying, Morris, that really adds to what you're saying about the mixtape. And then also a fourth one is you've got the newer generation. I forget the girl's name with the band where she was on stage and they were playing at the beginning, where she's saying, you know, we have t-shirts and we have the CD and the tape as well, you know. So it does really present all different aspects of it.
It's good you mentioned Henry Rollins, Tim, because at one point in the film, I think maybe the first time that we see him in the film, where he's walking down into his basement and we see this incredible collection of records and tapes, and the camera goes lovingly, pans up his cassette collection, and you think, wow, you know, he's really collected all these over the years, probably still making tapes, mixtapes as he can. But one thing he says...
The music industry has changed radically in our lifetime. And with it has changed the value of music. Now it's just this thing that you just download. So you're listening, something served to you from some cloud, something out in the ether, but you can't touch it. So what stays the same is analog. It always sounds good to the ear, and it's what's left of humanity meeting music.
I don't necessarily know that I agree with that. I mean, I understand that with the day and age that we're living in, record companies are wanting to go for something safe. Gone are the days where companies like Warner Brothers, which was like allegedly a company that was really out there to saying, oh, the first three albums didn't sell, we believe in you, record a fourth and a fifth one and then we'll talk. And we don't get that anymore. It's now like your first download didn't take off, right? Well, we're dumping you. There's only Universal left. But I'm thinking that he's tending to romanticize, all the more surprising for someone like Rollins, who was like a big speaker outer of truths, and this is where I think the industry and the state of the world is problematic. But he's romanticizing the whole notion that the music industry, back when he was in his heyday recording, record companies screwed over their artists. And I don't think it's the medium, whether it's a cassette, whether it's a CD, whether it's downloads. And he's also conveniently forgetting that something like Bandcamp is getting more music out there to the public than ever.
Right. But I think what it is too, I think what he's trying to say is that back in the day, It cost a lot more to make music. And it counted. You had to go in a studio, and if you screwed up, that was it. Now, music has become so disposable. Back in the day, we didn't have, you know, sure, you know, records were a lot cheaper, but, you know, in the past. But I remember the days of going into a record store, and I had $10, and I could buy maybe two albums. And I really had to decide what I wanted to buy, because what was going to be the best bang for my buck. And now it's just like, you know, because the artists aren't getting anything and everything is self throwaway today, that it's really changed the whole platform. I think that's what he was trying to say, is that now it's just like, you know, everything's almost like a popcorn fart with MP3s and everything. Even if it's a great song, it comes and it goes because it's just so disposable. And here's an interesting thing, too. Some people would argue that, you know, with the portability of the cassette compared to vinyl, that that was the beginning of the devaluing of music. That as it became more portable and more, you could tote it around or put it in your car or whatever, that it just became so commonplace that it was just like nothing. Whereas with a record, you actually had to be in a room, take it out of a sleeve, put it down in the device, drop the needle. It was a whole process. Whereas in your car, it was just kind of like, ding, Ted Nugent, boom, there you go.
That whole making that economic decision. I mean, I had one of my best friends growing up. It was like, well, I'm going to skip lunch so I can save that lunch money so I can buy a new cassette. Yep. And it was absolutely just this whole thing. It's like, had everything worked out to the penny, basically, for that. So many people hated cassettes because the artwork was shrunk down and it was just such a different presentation mode than albums. You know, with albums, you sit there, you stare at it, you read the liner notes, you open the gatefold, you do all this stuff. And then it's like, oh, well, cassette tapes, you know, you can fold them all out and everything, but it's a real pain in the ass to do all that kind of stuff. And then what do we get? We get CDs where it's just as bad. I mean, at least it's a square as far as that right. goes. And now it's MP3s. And I'm like, I have no idea. Now I have to go to allmusic.com if I'm going to find out anything about any of these bands.
Because discography.
I have no idea. Yeah. All of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm saying the portability, you know, really kind of devalued music.
Oh, yeah. Well, it hurt my heart to see the people driving around with the cassettes just laying loose in the back of their car. And I'm like,
right.
No, put those in cases, put those cases in something. Like, don't just let that stuff lay around loose, because otherwise it's going to slide right under the seat. It's going to get under your feet and it's going to sound like garbage next time you play it.
I mean, I get what you're saying, Tim and Mike, about the devaluing, but I think one of the points that the gentleman that was talking mostly about rap and hip hop, and I don't know his name, one of the things that he was saying was it was not devaluing so much as democratizing it, so that right. people who couldn't afford to go to this club or didn't live in New York in the city could vicariously enjoy a concert, because all of those, the rap and the hip hop shows were bootlegged crazily. And yep. so, you know, that was the norm. And so you passed it among all your friends, and that way everybody got to learn about these new bands. Otherwise, you would never have learned about these bands, because that in that particular crowd anyway. And I think the same goes with punk, because when I heard a lot of the first punk stuff that I heard was always on mixtape with just all different, you know, all different. And it would be like Jerry's Kid and 007 and Flipper and all these bands, you know, that would be, you know, on the same, these were like Boston ones, you know, Boston punk bands, but for the most part, I think that's what you would get, you know, and so that way you'd learn about all these different bands. And so it was a way of learning about a whole bunch of different bands all at once. And which you can't do unless you're rich and you can go and just buy all the records you see. Because you can't just do that. I mean, most people can't do that. So it's a way of, the mixtape aspect of it is a way of disseminating a lot of information to a lot of people. And so you're getting your name out there. Plus, a lot of these bands, one of the things was these guys in these bands, and I know for a fact, because I was in bands, that we would send in tapes to places to find, you know, say, play it on the radio. Can we get a gig? Things like that. I had a friend who actually had a little 8-track studio that he made stuff. For the most part, people didn't have that. And so you were using a cassette tape. What else were you going to use? And you'd send that tape in. And then that way your band could actually be seen and heard by someone. So there is an aspect, I guess, of devaluing it in a way, but it's also a democratizing, a way of just getting it out to the most people. And that's kind of neat.
That's what I was saying, Gary, about cassette tape being the internet before the internet. What you were talking about, that's exactly it. But here's a question. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever done this in the past. Did you ever go up to a soundboard and ask the sound guy to plug in? Have any of you ever done that?
Never had the nerve.
I wouldn't have the guts.
Nope. We used to go up and ask the sound guy. We'd say, listen, I'll buy you a beer. Can I plug in? And you plug in the cassette. And I remember one night specifically seeing Soul Asylum. And as funny as they became A&R darlings, when they started, they were amazing, right? And they put on some of the best live club shows I'd ever seen. And I remember one night where the sound guy's like, yeah, okay, plug in. You know, so we plugged in, and my friend Rick and I, Rick Montour, we plugged in his cassette player. And then for their encore, Soul Asylum goes and starts playing the theme song to James at 15. And then goes right from that into Sexual Healing, which just was like amazing, right? And they'd never played it before. And then after that, we had this bootleg cassette. It was just like, you got to hear this. And we just put it out. And then the next thing you know, they re-recorded that in the studio for, I think it was a benefit for Lucinda Williams or some, I think it was someone where they did a studio version of it. It was just, but it wasn't as good as live version. But we did a lot of that in the late 80s and early 90s where, you know, Husker Du, the Ramones, a lot of it, whereas we were just like, can we plug in? And as much as I'm not a deadhead, a lot of that came from the Dead, because there were guys that would go up to the soundboards, you know, on the West Coast and on the East Coast, and would follow the Dead and would say, listen, man, you know, here's some blotter, here's a bag of weed, you know, could I plug in? And then they would basically just let them plug in and they'd get their boot, and then they'd tape the show. And for everybody that couldn't get into the show, like Kerry said, who didn't have the liberty or, you know, it was sold out, that would basically, you'd go out on the street and then you'd figure out a way to, you know, duplicate your tape or whatever. It was basically like parlay, where you could parlay the bootleg of the last show, and that would make you enough money to get you to the next show. Kerry knows what I'm talking about, because they would actually have what they call J carts, which are like the inserts in cassettes. And I remember going to a Dead show where I walked in with like $30. It was an outdoor show, and I didn't know anything about the Dead because I just went with friends, and it was Tom Petty, Dylan, and the Dead. And I swapped a couple of beers for a J card that someone had done all this custom design on a cassette. And then I swapped that for a little bit of something else, something. It was almost like communism, man. Like, I'm just going like through this whole thing of swapping this for swapping that. And it was all passing on the music, right? And it was just incredible how all people wanted to do was hear the last show. And they didn't care how good it sounded. It was just, I wanted to hear Jerry. And I was just like, okay, I don't care how Jerry sounds. Here it is. You know, like, give me a sandwich. And it was just crazy.
With the Dead, you didn't have to plug in. All you needed was a crutch. He just put the tape, this microphone, on a crutch and held it up to the stage. Do you know how many people with broken legs were at the Dead shows half the time? That's funny. Yep.
It wasn't about commerce, but it was just like, if you were there at the show and you were able to get it physically, capture it, you know, like wrap it up, you could take it on. And that was parlay. Like, that was like basically like currency. Like, it just got you through to the next show. And I never, ever saw another band that you could do that with, aside from the tape trading community later in VHS and all that. But
so in the early 2000s, there was something of a CD trading community through the Yahoo groups. So before Facebook groups or whatever, or downloading became a thing, but there were tons of old bootlegs which people had either gone and recorded to tape and transferred to CD. So there were some terrible sounding ones, someone was holding a dictaphone in the air, but there were some that went to the desk. And I remember getting a bunch of Richard Thompson live things and some Los Lobos stuff. And Los Lobos, I believe, were completely cool with it, which was great for me because it was years and years before they came back to Australia. And as I've told you many times, Tim, my favorite working band on the planet. So it was great to hear them. But when CD became the new norm, recordable CDs became the new norm of getting that sort of stuff out. It was still physical medium, but just a different way of disseminating it. And I remember there was some of these groups that would start off what they called, I think, a tree and vines. So someone would say, I have a CD here of whatever, name your performer, this doing this performance. I'm making 5 copies. I'm sending it out to one to each region in the world that wants it. And then you nominate yourself. I'll send you a copy and then you send it on to the next person. You send it on to the next person. So it was still the spirit of what I understand about the tape trading community, which I was never involved in. But you know, in the 21st century, the early part of the 21st century, where CDs were the thing and people were happy to just put it in an envelope and send it on to the next guy. And it was all done in an honor system.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent any of this is going to survive as we move to the digital era. If not obsolete, the value will be in archiving a history and memorabilia. Although it may become important again in terms of reviving and sustaining underground, unsanctioned communication.
But you really made me think of something right now. It's like how everybody gives the kids shit today about holding up their phones and stuff, right? But I mean, the thing is, back in the day, there were bands that you get one night where they try something different, or one night where they ran out of songs, or they do a second encore or whatever. I had a bootleg recording on cassette of Husker Du with Grant Hart actually singing a cover of Buddy Holly's I Don't Care, She's So Square. And it was just like, damn, they never did it again. I'm not saying that today everybody's holding up their phone, forgetting something that they, you know, that once in a lifetime moment. It's more of a kind of just holding up the phone. But back in the day, like, it was this thing about you wanted to capture a moment because you never knew when somebody was going to go into something, or they just do something different. Or, you know, like a lot of bands when they tour, they do 30 dates straight. So on the 30th date or the 29th date, they're like, we're sick of this shit. We're sick of doing the whole album. Let's do something different. Let's do the Gilligan's Island thing. Bang. And then they just going into it, and you had it, and it was like capturing lightning in a bottle, you know.
I want to bring up an artist in the film, and we previously discussed a whole film dedicated to him, who very much encompassed the DIY aesthetic of tapes, and that was Daniel Johnson.
When I was first in Austin and I had those tapes, I would, anybody that looked like they were interested in music at all, even the slightest, they were cheap, you know, and I could make copies myself. And then after it was all over, and I really didn't have anything left, I had this tape of Hi, How Are You, and I got it published.
So there was a guy who wrote more songs than any record company, if he'd been allowed to go to a record company, which he eventually did, but he just thought, I've got a bunch of songs, I'm going to record them on a cassette player. I don't even think he had a Tascam or anything like that. He just had an ordinary cassette player, and Tascams are also worthy of a discussion. But I was wondering in advance, I wonder if Daniel Johnson shows up in this film, and boom, there he is, because he's the poster boy for the whole tape movement. So that brings into effect, like, what some of the artists are doing now that they show in the film. They're making their own tapes and they're selling it. And I'm thinking, Daniel Johnson, he was the guy who really made that an art form, did all his own artwork, and he was a great artist, recorded all these songs, manufactured all these tapes himself. He gives tapes a good name.
Daniel Johnson and a guy named Jandek. If you're ever looking up a guy named Jandek, was another guy that was huge. That was the same way.
It's funny because I was just watching a video about, I can't even remember the name of the band, but they were saying that one of their albums was named after the Jerky Boys. And then it's like, oh, and don't forget that Pablo Honey by Radiohead was also named after the Jerky Boys. The Jerky Boys was such a phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
Like years later, I was reading like, oh, yeah, when we were on tour with Nirvana, they just kept listening to this tape over and over again of these prank phone calls. And then they started to quote someone. I was like, that's the Jerky Boys, just like that phenomenon, like you're saying, of Daniel Johnson or Jandek or Wesley Willis even, or some of these like just bizarro things, like the whole Shut Up Little Man tape that was passed around so long. It's like this was such a phenomena, you know?
You reminded me, Mike, of the Red Bar, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a classic.
Because the Red Bar was almost like in The Simpsons, actually, used that with Moe.
Oh, yeah.
When Bart Simpson's always calling Moe, and you got Prince Albert in the can, let him out, you know, like that kind of thing, right? He said the Red Bar was this guy, Red, who was bartender, where the guy would call him, and Red's like, I'll murder you. I'll rip your head off. I'll shit down your neck. And it was all on cassette. That, you know, it was like from an answering machine that was in the bar. And it was somebody calling him and pranking him all the time. And it became a really famous phenomena where they, even to the point of where they did a short film with Lawrence Tierney called Red.
Chris Gore. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it was him flipping out and threatening this guy with bodily harm. And it was all on cassette first. It was this kind of phenomena, you know?
Yeah. The one part of the documentary that was really irking me, and this is probably just old man yells at clouds kind of thing, was the one guy who insists on releasing his new music on cassette only. And I was just like, that is such a just douche chill
hipster.
Yeah, exactly. It was just like, fuck you, dude. Just fuck you. It's like, there's so many bands right now where they're still just like, well, where are they going to release on vinyl? And I'm like, okay, well, enjoy that. I guess I could play it on my record player, but I don't care to if you just are going to insist on only releasing in one format.
Right. We recorded this on phonograph.
Yeah. I'm only releasing my movie on VHS. Okay.
Well, this book is in Braille only.
That's actually another point, because this film concentrates on the compact cassette as a medium and mostly talks about music as, you know, so as cassettes relate to musical artists. But the technology has changed for all sorts of mediums. And you mentioned there VHS, Mike, and I've seen some instances of romanticizing VHS tape. And funny thing, for all the fact that I still like getting CDs and, you know, physical medium music, I'm perfectly good with using a Kindle for reading. And actually, I've got you to thank for that, Mike, because all those books that you'd send, right, have a read of this before we do a projection booth episode. And I just think, we've got full bookshelves here. I've got nowhere to put any more books, right? Well, I got no problems with reading things on a Kindle. So I'm sort of partly in the past, and that may or may not be a nostalgia thing, but with books, I'm just being very pragmatic. And that's not to sell out anything. You know, Joanne is part of a book club and reads like 7 books a month or something like that. But she says, I don't get the Kindle. I said, well, to each their own. But this whole film, I think, one thing I do like about the film is that even though it is playing with nostalgia, some of the people who they speak to in the film, and we're not just talking about Lou Ottens, who cries, hey, we got to move on to the future, but some of these people who say, oh yeah, I love tape, but I'm under no illusions that it's a better sounding medium. And the thing is, it's a nostalgia for people who weren't there at the time.
I wanted to share a story that's kind of, that just came to mind. It was really funny because I used to put out a lot of zines in the zine era, and one of the funniest things, and it was so funny that a lot of it wasn't just one band that did this, and I'm not going to name names, there was a number of bands that were guilty of doing this, right? But back in the day, it would be where bands that would tour would get promotional cassettes. And either like things that had just come out, or they'd get demos from other bands or whatever. And you go town to town and people would hand you, you know, at the bar or whatever, hand you the cassette, right? And then there was always the crash pad where, you know, you'd stay for the night. And what a lot of bands told me over and over and over is it was like, well, we used to put tape over the cassettes, and whoever had a record collection, we just basically tape what we wanted to listen to on the cassette for the band.
So
they did that over and over and over. As much as we're talking about the importance of the cassette and how vital it was, it goes kind of go back to what Morris is saying about the disposability of it as well, where, you know, a lot of bands were just kind of like, they'd listen to 5 minutes, honestly, of a demo and just go, okay, put on the tape, drop the tape, across the top. It's like, oh, what, you know, you got a Stooges bootleg? All right, we'll tape over that and then for the van, you know? And as much as it sounds rude now, it was just funny at the time, where it was just kind of like, it's a cassette. We're on tour. We don't have money to buy cassettes.
Exactly.
For young people, too, there's one point, and I'm having a brain fart right at the moment. I'm forgetting. What was the advertisement on television? You remember, everybody remembers the guy sitting in the chair.
Oh, the Maxwell, Memorex. Wasn't it? Memorex, there you go.
It was Memorex, right, when his hair is blowing back, and right.
Is it live or is it Memorex?
Is it live or is it Memorex? And then they did one with, wasn't it with Aretha, with the breaking the glass?
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, with Aretha Franklin, where she was singing, and they say, is it live or is it Memorex?
1, 2. They made a brand new tape, as you can see.
New MRX 3 Oxide from Memorex.
See the sound so true, my dears, you won't believe your ears.
Ooh. MRX 3 Oxide makes the difference.
You get higher highs and even lower lows. Is it 3 or me?
Nobody knows.
Now, more than ever, we can ask, is it live or is it Memorex?
I have a feeling like there were ads over here for TDK that did a similar sort of thing. There's the irony is that these companies would want to point out the great dynamic range of cassettes. And certainly, you know, depending on how much you spent on tapes, whether you got the Ferris ones or whether you got just the ordinary TDK D90s or something
Full
like that,
sides.
Where you get a better sound. But most people would just say, right, you know what? I'd rather spend $15 and get a box of 10 cheap grade TDK D90s or something like that, rather than spending $100 and getting 10 perfect cassettes. And, you know, probably that was a good move, because I don't think really many people were buying cassettes for their audio properties. I mean, we shit on them now, but at the time we didn't care. We just thought, I want to hear this song anytime I want to hear it, and it's good enough. That leads me, I guess, to a subject that we brought up a little bit earlier, but want to maybe discuss a little bit more, is the whole home taping is killing music campaign. It was bad enough that you'd see them in magazines, but they started putting, I think maybe on CBS Records, I don't know about other companies, they'd have like the little logo for Home Taping is Killing Music on the back of the record cover, the skull and crossbones, well, not the skull, the tape and crossbones on the back of a record, basically saying, show some moral fortitude, do not tape this for your friends, let them buy this record. The record industry is losing a ton of profit. And I haven't gone and studied the books, I don't know, but it would seem to me it was bullshit, because we're hearing how, especially in the 80s, where Michael Jackson's selling Thriller through the roof and Bruce Springsteen selling Born in the USA like nobody's business. And there were tons of records that were selling millions of things. But the record companies are saying, well, don't you cut in on our profit margin. We better tell you that we're losing profits here. And like, boo-hoo. I mean, okay, I understand there is a moral issue and an ethical issue, but hell, when the more stories that I've heard over recent years about artists owing money to record companies because the number of records that they sold didn't cover the advance that was given them, and you got some artists who even did sell a ton of records, and yet they're still living off baked beans. So me calling out the record companies for saying, oh, you're stealing, poor us. But I don't know. I'd be interested in your guys' thoughts. Is the moral fortitude, as they would call it?
Alternative Tentacles with Jello Biafra, where they actually said, you know, the music industry is killing home taping. And they actually had these cassettes where they tape on the other side, tape whatever you want on the other side. And they actually put out cassettes, one with the whole album on one side and the other side was blank. And I just thought that was fucking brilliant, man. Like, that was like, you know, stick it to the man. Because the thing was, it was almost like, you know, and I'm not trying to go off on a different tangent, but it's almost like the whole thing about marijuana, where they couldn't corner the industry on marijuana, so nobody could get it. And then they're demonizing it, right? And it's the same thing with the cassette player, where, you know, you could record whatever you wanted, and they're like, they couldn't control it. They didn't have any legality on it. And they were just like, wait a minute. They demonized it, you know?
You wouldn't download a car.
Right.
We had this legal device, the tape recorder, but the industry is saying, well, it's only meant for recording your own personal demos, or if you want to send an audio letter to your friend, but don't go recording anything off the radio, and don't go recording your friend. Never mind that they made these 3-in-1 audio systems where you'd have a record player and a radio and a tape recorder, and you can record off the record, but don't do it. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm. So, you can only record his master's voice.
To me, I think that's one thing that I think the film left out, that I would have liked to have seen their perspective on it. I know that they wanted to romanticize the notion of, hey, aren't tapes wonderful? And isn't it a shame that they're not as ubiquitous in our lives as they used to be? And isn't it great that some people today are trying to bring it back? But I think that this whole home taping thing, it was basically a propaganda campaign by the the record industry. Right. It was a very, very big part of the tape and record story in the 80s and the 90s. I don't think so much in the 70s, but the 80s and the 90s, that was a very big thing. And then CDs come along and recordable CDs, and the record industry thought, we're fucked. Oh, yeah. And then Napster comes along and we're double fucked. But that should have been part of the film, in my opinion.
Go ahead, there was
an opportunity missed.
Well, it's funny because that same guy that was talking about concentrated mainly on rap and hip hop, was talking about the fact that it was outside of, what did he say, outside of state surveillance, that nobody could control, as you were saying, nobody can control what it is that you're putting on this tape. And you can put anything on this tape that you want, whether or not, if you're going to sell it, okay, that's piracy, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you can put anything on this tape. And it made me think of that movie, Mercury Rising. And, you know, like, at one point, they're trying to think of a way to communicate with one another. And he's like, how am I supposed to send a note, because everything that I send is being surveilled by the CIA or something. So they're at a flea market and they see a typewriter, like an actual completely regular old typewriter, and they're like, ding. And I just kept thinking about that, like when he was saying that, it's like, I would never have an Alexa in my home. It just, the idea does not make me happy. Or the smart home thing of turn off the lights, you lock the door, whatever it is, I would, it's not my thing. But that just hit me. And it also occurred to me how much we used to get, because my aunt lived in Japan for like 7 years, and she used to regularly send us tapes. Because you couldn't call. I mean, at that time, you couldn't make...
The cost of long distance, ridiculous.
Very often. You know, once a year or something, she would call at Christmas or something. But the rest of the time, she would send tapes, and she would just mention everybody's name. She would be like, and I hope you're still taking dance lessons, and I hope you're still playing baseball, and have a great time, and da-da-da-da-da, happy 7th birthday, and all this stuff. There's a whole scene in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Where a young guy is listening to the tape of his mother when he gets shot, and then you can hear his mother still talking. Oh,
right. Spoilers.
Mission Impossible.
One guy I wish they had put it in this documentary that I think is vital to the whole aspect of the cassette culture is Ice-T. Because Ice-T, when he started it, when he was younger, he put out Pusher.
Yo, it's time for me to pump up the volume. No problem, the record's revolving. Evil's the mixer, I'm the rap trickster. Paparazzi's on the bum rush for pictures. Ice, cooler, yo, colder than ever. Punk executioner, he pulls the lever. Rotate the wax, then cut and axe the tracks. Push up the levels till the red light's max. Don't try to size up, you better wise up to the rap criminals. We're on the rise up, we're selling dope. Till we succeeded, dope beats and lyrics, no beepers needed.
And it was a cover of Curtis Mayfield's The Pusher. But instead of talking about pushing drugs, he was talking about pushing demos. Hey, man, you want to get high? Get high on this. You know, and he's dropped, whoa, man, those are some wicked beats. You know, but it's a Curtis Mayfield cover. And he was so genius in doing this, where with the whole hip hop culture, it was like, if you were coming up, you had to basically do it privately and just get your beat down and get your flow down. And then you could drop it on people, just like it's like, you know, pure smack. You put out the single, The Pusher. But he was using the metaphor of, you know, when Curtis Mayfield was talking about straight drugs, you know, Ice-T was talking about beats. The way that, as much as, you know, we're going on about how cassettes are so disposable, is viral. And it was just the way that he could just get his name. You know, it was your calling card. Whereas, you know, if you're selling insurance, you hand somebody, you know, a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. If you're a rapper, you hand your tape. And that's what it was, man.
So who came up with the idea of Cassette Store Day?
Yes, I take credit for the idea.
And responsibility.
And it was a shit idea anyway.
While we've been talking, I've been trying to think, are there any great songs that are love letters to tape? And the only one that comes into my head is Answering Machine by The Replacements.
Yes.
And I mean, that song, if not for the invention of the tape, I mean, it's a very specific type of tape, but song couldn't
do an answering machine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe not a love letter, but
some of those answering machine messages made me remember, like, gosh, there's a song on that Teenage Riot. What's the name of the, like, one of the best Sonic Youth albums ever? There's one whole song where there's
Daydream Nation.
There's one whole song where there's stuff from a answering machine, or at the end, it's an answering machine. There's Ben Folds 5. There's an answering machine one as well. And it's just like taking these messages.
That's the talk from his father. That's right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're just so personal, you know?
Here's one that's funny. And going back to our first episode of See Here was Gigi Allen. I forget, it was a mixed album that had vinyl, where the guy calls up and he's like, Gigi Allen, I'm going to kill you and throw you in the Charleston River. The guy's flipping out. He's like, have a good night. That's how he ends it. But he's like, he's threatening him with murder and everything. He's like, have a good night, Blake.
Well, all right, this is Tom's got a fight, man. I'm back. We really need to speak to Gigi. So when you get the chance, please give us his phone number. Our number is 67. Gigi Allen is
bad. They Might Be Giants so should have been in this documentary as well. I mean, their whole answering machine thing that they still run today, right?
Yeah, dial a song.
And then having that song on Miscellaneous Tea where you've got the woman and the guy. They're talking about giants and da-da-da. You know, like that whole thing is right off the answering machine. Not to say that I don't skip that song every time it comes up, but, you know.
And Jonathan Richman. Jonathan Richman was another guy who came up with cassette culture too. It was huge. I remember hearing I'm a Little Dinosaur as a cassette single, and it was just incredible. Like, I mean, like, there was a lot of guys, people, and again, it was because of people not having the money but still having the artistic drive. And it's even like today, like when people talk about, well, it's just a 4-track recording, right, or whatever, and it's like there were people doing shit on 2 tracks, like, mm-hmm. just even nothing.
Well, I can remember buying cassettes at concerts. I bought a Jeff Healey cassette at one of his shows.
That goes back to recording off the board. What I was saying was they would record it live off the board and have somebody be able to do duplicates of it or record half a set. They used to do sets because the half set would be, okay, we got the set, start recording. And then they have like 4 or 5 things and be able to like pump it out. Right? And Radiohead was doing that now with MP3s where they would just have the live file. But that all came from the start of cassette culture.
When I lived out in California, I used to go to shows out there, and the Jeff Healey band played at the Monterey Pop, which is still exists. It's not the like Jimi Hendrix, it's smaller, but it's still there, you know. But he played there, and I got a tape from him, a cassette tape. And this other guy called Alligator, who was a blues guy, but he was fabulous. He was this older guy, and he definitely had been through it, you know, and he was just like playing and played great guitar. It was such a part of the night, you know. It was like a memory of the night. And what was great about cassette that differed from an album is that you could get in the car and put it in.
Yep.
And you're like, you know, I just heard him in concert and now I'm putting it in, and I can like, oh wow, that he did that tune, or that he does the tune differently live than he does, you know, in the studio. And to me, that was kind of a cool thing. I wasn't a huge cassette person. I really wasn't. But I also, the language thing, because I was a linguist, and I took languages all through school, and then when I was in the military, always on cassette, so you could go home and practice and listen along to the, you know, to the tape. And they were so easy. You could throw it in your backpack. I mean, it didn't weigh anything, and you can't scratch it. So, I mean, there's something to that. The fact that it is so easy to take around. I had a little cooler, and that's what I used in my car to hold cassette tapes, because maybe it would keep them from burning or like getting too hot in the sun when you left your car out all day or something.
You believe Bangladesh? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I have a question for you guys. Do you remember a song? And it was like, I think from an indie artist where they used a sample off a cassette of almost like a language language instructional cassette, where it was almost like learning French or something. It was the beginning of the song where they say it in English, like I like cats. And then it would say something in French, and then it went right into the song. I remember like hearing stuff on college radio. There was a couple of bands that would do that, where they would actually go to like the thrift stores and find whatever cassettes they could find. And again, going back to sampling, like I was saying about Steel Pole Bathtub, where they would actually sift through whatever the, you know, the 50 cent bin at the thrift store and grab all these old cassettes and use them as samples to put them, interject them into their song.
Oh yeah. There was a restaurant I used to go to that had free sermons on cassette. You could just grab those as you went in and out of the restaurant. And you better believe I loaded up on sermons. It's those weird, like ephemeral things. Like when Morris and I were talking about college radio, I forgot to talk about all of the 45s that they would have for PSAs and stuff. But also I had cassette PSAs or like instructional things. I mean, hell guys, there were porn cassettes. You could go to the adult bookstore and buy like so-and-so hot stories and listen to that in your car if you're an absolute freak.
So did you ever in your DJ days play cassettes in the studio?
I tried to avoid it just because of the sound quality.
But they did have it available.
They did have it available, and that's where I recorded all my stuff as well. So I could do input or output from the cassette player. And so when I recorded myself, I would record it on that one.
They were cassettes, not carts?
Correct. Yeah, we had carts, but the carts were just for station IDs. We weren't playing songs off of those. We were playing records, CDs, because CDs were still relatively new at that time, and occasionally cassettes. And then, carts were just for station identification. Like if I made like a few carts while I was there, but it wasn't like, let's throw that sucker on.
The only time you'd use cassettes in college radio is when you want to basically play an interview that you did with a band.
Right.
Because you went to the show and you would record the band and that was it. Like, pretty much.
If somebody explicitly said, you're an idiot for releasing music on cassette tape, then I would say nothing. And I think I would take my headphones and I'd put them back on, press play, and fuck off in the other direction.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about our own personal perspective, and that was probably going to be inevitable with a film like this. But just one final go around, final thoughts, recommendations for this film, Mike?
I enjoyed it. Like I said, it was a little muddled. I usually don't care to listen to Henry Rollins, but I actually really liked him in this documentary. I thought that everything he had to say was pretty interesting. And I could actually tell he and Ian MacKaye felt like they were getting kind of choked up a few times. Thurston Moore, would they have like 15 minutes with him? He's barely in this movie. That was kind of weird. But yeah, I liked a lot of it. I wouldn't rush out to see it. I actually, with the name having mixtape in there, I was hoping it was going to be all about mixtapes. And I think you could do a 90-minute documentary on mixtapes without a problem. But yeah, I'm more than anything, I'm glad that we had this conversation, because this is what I am enjoying more than the actual movie itself.
Mike's got a really good point there. This has been a very nice conversation too. Yeah. I would feel bereft if I didn't mention High Fidelity. I just feel like I have to. Because the whole time I kept thinking about that movie.
The making of a great compilation tape, like breaking up, is hard to do and takes ages longer than it might seem. You got to kick it off with a killer to grab attention. Then you got to take it up a notch, but you don't want to blow your wad. So then you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules.
I enjoyed it partially because there's stuff that I didn't know. Like, I didn't know much about the rap and hip hop scene. And so I didn't realize that that is how a lot of the music was disseminated. I thought that was really, to me, that was fascinating, because it was not, it's not a genre of music that I know that much about, to be honest with you. So if that to me was fascinating to find that out, and also to find out that people are still recording on cassette, which I actually had read that the one guy, as Mike said, the one guy that was saying he's only releasing his music on cassette. Yes. And he also rides a penny farthing to work, and he has a handlebar mustache, you know, what the hell, you know, he's going to go to his job as an artisanal pencil sharpener or something, you know, I don't know.
He carves the styrofoam peanuts that you put in the packages, each one.
Yeah. I thought something really interesting in this, whereas Lou's talking about, he understands the framework of mortality, saying that, you know, as human beings, we've only got so much time on this planet. And so he wants to keep going forward to keep refining his inventions and his creations and going into the CD and beyond. But I think that at the same time, he's kind of pulled back by something in the cassette that he really can't put his finger on. There's still something in the cassette that is so pure and organic and something there. Because initially in the beginning of the documentary, he's just like, next. But then when he's playing the tapes and he's looking at them, he's kind of going, yeah, but there's that, and he's kind of like, there's that thing. And as much as he wants to go with his engineer sensibility and go forward, there's something that he tapped into with the cassette that I think he recognizes. It's almost like a personal struggle because he's the creator as much as there was the other guys, you know, and I wish I had heard from the other guys as well with this, but I really picked up on that. It wasn't him just being like, that's my baby out in the world, you can do whatever it wants to. No, he's kind of got this pull to it where it kind of still grounds him where he has to let it go because of the binds of mortality that he's only got so much time. And unfortunately, now he's gone.
I think you're projecting, Tim.
Maybe I am.
I think that it was the engineer in him that admired what he'd achieved. Maybe not even so much what he'd achieved, as he said, as part of a team. And it was a beautiful thing to say, well, no, it wasn't just me. It was these three guys as well. And which was truly a lovely thing. So I think it was the engineer in him that admired what they'd accomplished. But as you say, the engineer in him also said, no, we've got to move on. We've got to move on. Yeah, we did something back then, but they found other ways to bring music out to the public. And that's perfectly fine by me. Every generation's got to find its way. And, you know, like 60 years after its invention, if it was still the predominant form of personal recording, there would be something wrong. And who knows what's going to happen down the track. This reinvigoration of records, which, as interestingly enough, in the films, they point out it's not as big as anyone thinks. It's only a small percentage of the physical media market or of the musical market. You get, and really with records being charged at $50-$60 a pop nowadays, no wonder. And most independent musicians who say, I'd like to be immortalized on this beautiful invention, the record, but because it's me as an independent, I can only put out 300 copies of this record and then I'm done. Yeah, we sold that, but you only had 300 copies. So it's still, for all the so-called reinvigoration of tapes and records that they talk about in the film, it's in small numbers and really the streaming services, for like them or hate them, they're here to stay. That's going to be the way of the future.
With any artist, no matter whether it's visual, film, audio, whatever, you cannot control how it's going to be interpreted once it's put out there. It's like a fart. You know, some people are going to think it stinks. Some people are not going to notice it at all. Some people might think it's a little loud. Some people might tell you to tone it down, whatever. But you cannot control how it is taken in once you put it out there. And I think that Lou realized that with the cassette, it's like, yes, you know, it might have been profound and you can take pride in that, but I can't control how people are going to suss it out and basically what they take away from this. I just put it out there. That's it. That's the end of it. So I think he was being pragmatic in that.
Very much. All right. Well, I, like you guys, probably got far more out of this conversation. I still think it was a lovely film. I really did. And I'm glad that you picked this, Tim. But yeah, I think it's conversations like this about our personal connections. And listeners out there, find a group of your friends. Have your own conversations after you listen to this and reminisce. Be nostalgic if you want to. Be harsh, whichever way you want to do. The whole thing about tape as a physical medium is a metaphor for everything. Here you are. You're listening to this podcast on a device. This conversation is on something that is not physical. It's an MP3. For whatever we decry about the streaming services or MP3s, it allows us to have these conversations. You know, Mike has done, God knows how, over 1,000, well, so like 650 or 660 official episodes of The Projection Booth, but hundreds more of special reports. And so that invention has allowed us, it's easier than ever to get our thoughts out there for you to listen to. So we can't always decry modern technology. It moves on. Lou Ottens was certainly onto something. So with that, thank you very much, Mike, for once again being on the show.
Well, thank you.
What's coming up in the booth over the next few months? I know that you plan your shows a year in advance. You are the hardest working man in podcasting. I've said that before and I'll say it again. So what is coming up over the next few months? Well, the next couple of months over on the detection booth?
I'll give you 3 months. So April is going to be all Japanese films.
Nice.
May is all comedy. And then June is another grab bag. It is all requests from my Patreon donors. So
nice.
Got some interesting, actually fairly mainstream stuff like The Executioner Song, Cool Hand Luke, The Trial by Orson Welles, and The Graduate. So they are nice. They're not torturing me with too many obscure things right now.
So in your Japanese month, in your comedy month, are you going for more well-known or more obscure cuts?
Well, the guy that did Paprika, we're talking about his Millennium actress.
Nice, Satoshi Kon, yeah.
Yeah, R100, which was actually put out by...
Matsumoto.
Yeah, put out by Alamo Drafthouse, I believe. Then we're getting into some more obscure stuff. And then when it comes to the comedies, yeah, these are all pretty mainstream things like Bowfinger, Tango and Cash.
I love Bowfinger.
Hudsucker Proxy, 3 o'clock High. So yeah, not digging too deep with those. The most obscure, quote unquote, is just because they're older and we're doing a Preston Sturges double feature of Miracle at Morgan's Creek and Hail the Conquering Hero.
Wow. Nice.
So it was a couple of years ago when you did screwball comedies and I was privileged enough to be part of a conversation about My Man Godfrey, which was lovely. But yeah, I wish that there'd be a lot more focus in amongst film lovers on screwball comedies, because as we said at the time, they were cherished back in the day.
Have you ever seen Matsumoto's film Symbol?
I haven't, but I recently illegally downloaded it.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, that's a wicked film. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I've got that and Scabbard Samurai that I haven't watched.
I'm writing all this down.
So I'll talk to you briefly about what we got coming up next month. The next 2 months, we've got interviews, and based on a conversation that I had with Tim before we started that, maybe the next 3 months. But next month, this is something that I'd organized maybe October last year, but there's a new book coming out from a journalist called Daniel Devise. He previously had gone and written a book about B.B. King. I think it's called King of the Blues, but he's putting out a new book. I think it might be out by the time this show drops. It's called The Blues Brothers: An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. Now, I'm not sure, Tim or Kerry, whether you've read the book, but I absolutely devoured this book a couple of months ago, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Daniel, because this is a film that plays a large part in a lot of people's lives, regardless of whether they're hardcore film lovers or just casual film lovers. People have seen this hundreds of times. I thought that this book was going to be exclusively about the making of the Blues Brothers. They go way back to Belushi and Aykroyd's beginnings as kids, and how they came up through Second City, which was why I was asking you, Kerry, I think, about Second City a couple of shows back. And also in Toronto as well.
Right, exactly.
The story about the Blues Brothers comes maybe about halfway through the book, but the story about them coming up through improv and their own beginnings is absolutely crucial to telling the story about the Blues Brothers. So looking forward to speaking to Daniel and about his research next month.
And the use of cocaine was involved in no way whatsoever.
No, not at all.
That, living.
That's discussed a lot in the book. I might get in another couple of viewings of the film itself before we talk about that on the show.
You got to love those Illinois Nazis.
We got both kinds of music, country and western.
Oh, I forgot Charles Napier. And you know, I have to say one thing that is funny is I always love that line when he says it's kind of hard to eat corn when you have no fucking teeth.
Napier, man, classic.
I remember taping the Blues Brothers off television many, many years ago, and this is back in the day before swearing was allowed on television.
Right. Oh, right. Classic.
Right.
Classic.
The re-editing of cuss words. Oh, yeah.
The modified TV version. So I remember this moment gave me a lot of amusement. Charles Napier, Santa Belushi, you're going to look pretty funny eating corn on the cob with no tooth. You know, that drop in the
voice. Oh, no tooth. Scene in the nun's office. Oh my God. I said, you're up the creek. Yeah. Those buzzards are ours now.
Oh yeah.
So, next month we speak to Daniel Devise about his new book on the Blues Brothers. Very, very excited to that.
You know, when I was a kid, we went to the drive-in. My mom and dad took us, and it was a triple bill. It was the first Smokey and the Bandit film, the Blues Brothers, and the Jerk.
What a triple bill.
That's a great triple.
Yeah.
So until next month, look after yourselves, watch some great movies, listen to some great music on cassette, even open if you want. Absolutely.
On tape.
On tape. And until we speak again, all the best. Cheers.
Cheers.
Aloha.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.